The following program is a JWC Media production for Game Show Newsnet and CLW83.com.
Gentlemen, this is Jason Block with WLTI Live at, on the CLW83.com network and, of course, Game Show Newsnet. And on September 16th, we are going to have the 30th season premiere of a little quiz show called Jeopardy. And what I am very pleased to announce is that executive producer of Jeopardy and, of course, Wheel of Fortune is back with another go-around with us. Mr. Harry Friedman, how are you, Harry?
I'm great, Jason. Thank you. Good to talk to
Thank
you.
Thank you so much. Before we go on to the 30th season, I want to just go back to the end of the 29th for a second. Can you just please clarify one more time for everyone who does not understand it, what the ruling was against Thomas Hurley III and the Emancipation Proclamation misspelling at the end of Kidswick?
Sure. We have a general rule about Final Jeopardy, and that is that if a Final Jeopardy response is written down and as read, if it can be pronounced the same way that it should sound if spelled correctly, then the contestant gets credit for it. So, for example, I know we had a couple of instances where the correct response was Hannibal Lecter, and another one where the correct response was Hindenburg, and a couple of the contestants spelled spelled those responses incorrectly. But when read, it was pronounced the same way as if it were spelled correctly. So they got credit for it. In the case of Emancipation, there was an extra letter added, so when you went to read it, it could not be pronounced Emancipation. It would have been pronounced Emancipation.
Emancipation. That was, I believe, the correct.
Right. There was an added letter.
Right, and an added syllable, I believe.
Just an added letter.
Okay.
And so, therefore, we could not allow that response.
Now, were you surprised by the reaction at that point? Because there was a bit of a, you know, just sort of a give it to him anyway sort of reaction to it.
Well, as a former contestant yourself, you know that that's not a good principle to follow.
Believe me, I know. And we actually supported your decision and the producer's decision because rules are rules. And, you know, you're right. But I was a bit surprised by it myself.
Yeah, there's either right or wrong. There's no degree of right. You can't say one answer is more right than another. It can only be right or wrong. And it's not always that black and white. Sometimes, you know, these are judgment calls, and it's especially painful when there's a young man involved who felt like he had written down the correct response. And it's Kids Week, and as a parent myself, I know how I would feel if it were my kid. But if it came down to the final two, let's say there had only been two contestants playing, and one wrote down emancipation spelled correctly, and the other one wrote it down spelled incorrectly, would you give it to both of them? Because they can't both be right if one spelling is wrong.
Exactly.
So this sparked a lot of very spirited debate, and it was, believe me, it was not an easy decision to make. I also found it very interesting that so many people who did not see the episode had opinions about what had really happened, and I really disliked the characterization in some of the media that the young man said, and I don't know that he said this or not afterwards, that he had been cheated.
I believe there were some articles to that effect, which was really...
Yeah.
And
the fact is, he was cheated out of nothing. The fact is that he would have finished second, whether he was right or wrong. And on the Kids Week shows, the winner gets to keep whatever he or she wins with a minimum guarantee. Second place gets $1,000. Second place gets $2,000. Third place gets $1,000, just like on our regular adult shows. And so he would have gotten $2,000 right or wrong. So he was really cheated out of nothing. Again, this was very, very, very tough for us to deal with because there are emotions involved. But there are also rules, and we've prided ourselves for now, at the start of our 30th season, being fair and hopefully being correct and accurate and representing a level of excellence that very often is in short supply. So to have sort of given in to the mentality of saying, oh, come on, he's a kid, give it to him, that's not Jeopardy.
That, you know, it's very, 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 very well put. Okay, so let's go back to 30 years ago, you know, 1983, 84, when the show was off the air for 7 years. Do you remember how the show was brought back into the syndication?
As I understand it, the story goes that Merv Griffin's shows and Wheel of Fortune first went into syndication and did well. And at that point, King World, which was distributing the show, basically said, what else you got? And so the hour, at least in most of the country, except in the Midwest, but the hour of prime access was opening up, and there were opportunities for other shows. And I think, in fairness, I don't think that there was a belief that a hard quiz show was going to succeed.
If I remember my game show history in the first year or two, Jeopardy was on the O&Os on ABC at like 2:30 in the morning. If I remember.
Oh, it was on some terrible terrible time period.
Yeah, you know, people who are under the age of 30 don't understand how hard it was back then.
Mm-hmm. You know? Eventually, there were upgrades, I think, because I don't think that the shows were on the ABC O&Os originally. I think they were on a bunch of CBS stations and other stations. So, there's a lot of revisionist history that goes on in thinking that, sometimes thinking that the show was successful from day one, which it was not. But I think that there was a growing desire and a growing need for quality, solid quiz show programming. And eventually, it caught on.
Did you have a relationship with Merv Griffin during those first years at all?
I did not, because I joined Wheel in late 94, early 95. And by that point, Merv was really no longer actively involved in the day-to-day production of the shows, having sold them to Coca-Cola, which then was acquired by Columbia, then Sony. And so I did not have that much of a relationship with Merv.
Mm. Okay, let me just ask you one of the most simple yet most complex questions. What do you think makes a good Jeopardy contestant?
a good Jeopardy contestant, besides obviously being very fast and being able to recall information very, very quickly, and being able to use that signaling button, the dreaded signaling button, I think a good Jeopardy contestant, first and foremost, is a regular viewer of the show and understands sort of the realm in which we operate, in which our game material lives, understands some of the Jeopardy shorthand, understands that in many clues, there are going to be clues within clues that help you get to the correct response. To really have good comprehension and read the clue, understand the clue, and then ring in. Now, I know that's asking a lot, but there are also certain, I think, techniques that are very, very, very important, and they're basic. We always tell the contestants, take the lowest value clues first, get into the category, and then get to the higher ones. Really, really go down the whole board. And for a lot of people, they don't like that as a strategy. They don't like to play it safe. They want to jump around and look for the daily doubles. And long term, that doesn't generally work.
Okay. Well, sort of on that vein, why do you think that, you know, because you were one of the first game shows to take and successfully incorporate online testing to get contestants on the show. Why do you think that has been such a successful component for your show?
It helps demystify the whole process. A lot of people who think they can pass the Jeopardy test but are afraid to try it, if they take the online test and they realize, you know, maybe I should do this. Maybe I know more than I thought I did. So it's a real confidence builder, first of all. And it's also a good reality check. Conversely, there are people who think they would do well, and maybe they take the test and say, ooh, this is too tough. It has also made the being a contestant far more accessible to an awful lot more people. We have, I think in the first year that we administered the online test, we ended up with contestants across the season from 80 different markets, and not just the big metropolitan areas where we typically draw most of our contestants from. So it was a wonderful success. It was an experiment that has proved remarkably successful. I think more than 1 million people by now have taken the test.
That's an amazing thing, because a lot of people, just from a contestant background, it's not easy to go into a room of people, take the test, and then do the personality interview, the playing of the game, which is the second half
right.
of the application process. But if you can go sit with your cup of coffee or your whatever you drink at that certain time during those times of the year, you should do it. It's the worst you could do is you could try again. That's what I say.
It also has enabled people who are otherwise might say, you know, I'm really too busy to do this. A lot of doctors, a lot of clergy, a lot more, I should say, have taken the test, and a lot more women. The last couple seasons, I believe we've had an equal number of men and women in our contestant pool, and in fact, I think in one or two recent seasons, we've actually had more women than men in the contestant pool.
From 1998 to 2001, there was a spinoff of your show called Rock and Roll Jeopardy with a little unknown guy named Jeff Probst. You might have heard of him. I don't know.
Yeah, whatever happened to that
Yeah,
guy.
Exactly.
The guy with the dimples.
Yeah, the guy with the dimples. and the blue denim shirt. Yeah. Now, what was that like? And did you have any inkling back then that he would be as successful as he is now?
I have to say I did. We spotted Jeff. I think he was a field reporter for Access Hollywood at the time that we auditioned him. And he was among over 60 potentials who auditioned to host Rock and Roll Jeopardy. And he walked in and he just nailed it. He just absolutely nailed it. He had done his homework. He was supremely prepared. He looked over the interview notes with the contestants. He asked interesting questions. He listened to their answers before asking a follow-up question. He was terrific and a lot of fun to work with. He got the Survivor gig right sort of, I believe, after our first or second cycle of Rock and Roll Jeopardy. So we had to work around his schedule, which he was very accommodating about. And he was just great. And Rock and Roll Jeopardy comes up all the time. I'm constantly asked, do you think there'll ever be a time when it will come back? And personally, and I think speaking for the rest of the staff, we would love it because it was so much work and so much fun.
And he also seems to be a friend of the show. I mean, he made an appearance a couple of years ago on the April Fool's episode.
Oh yeah. Yeah, he's a great guy. I'm sorry his talk show didn't work. I think his heart was in the right place though.
Mm. Speaking of celebrities, of course, we've seen, you know, a boatload of celebrities play for charity. Do you have any particular favorites?
I have a lot of favorites. I have a lot of folks, especially this last time around when we did our Power Players Week in Washington, because it was on a Saturday. It was in the spring of an election year. And here were people who were giving up very, very precious free time to come and play for charity. And I was pretty impressed.
Now, sort of on a secondary question of that, celebrities read a lot of clues over the years. Do you just have them read a bunch of clues at once or during that time? Because sometimes you'll see a celebrity throughout the entire season do certain categories.
Right. We usually only have one opportunity to get in front of them and have them shoot clues for us. So there are some that we'll use more immediately, and then we'll bank the rest and dole them out over the course of the season.
Yeah, okay. Now, November 2001, you double the value. And then you ended, unfortunately for me, the five-game limitation.
Right.
Are those sort of other ways just to freshen the show? And what goes into decisions to making the game different or adding those elements? Similar to the Wheel of Fortune question I asked you back then.
Well, that decision in particular was at least 3 years in the making. We went back and forth on that. There was, you know, one side of the discussion was, well, if it ain't broke, don't fix it. And another side said, you know, another point of view was also, gee, this could get really expensive. My view from the beginning was that there should be no limitation on excellence. And that as long as someone can keep winning, they should be allowed to do so. We didn't expect someone to win 74 games.
You know, I'm going to get into that in a second because I remember when that started to come out in 2000, mm-hmm. where there were inklings of this streak and the streak. And so kind of take us through when Ken Jennings, for those who don't know, won 74 games, going through that from the producer's perspective.
Well, it was all on uncharted waters. It was completely unknown to us. We were very, very, very careful to write the games. Even once he started his streak, we wrote the games exactly as we would have at any other time. And in fact, most of the games that were played during that time were written months earlier. And so we produced the games, we played the games exactly as they were written and locked away, because we didn't want to ever be accused of, nor did we have any desire to, amend the material in any way, shape, or form. These are the Jeopardy games. These are the games we're going to play today. Yeah, of course, we knew that Ken had an incredible encyclopedic knowledge of a lot of things, especially movies. Well, we weren't going to take out a movie category or add a movie category to affect the outcome of the game one way or the other. I mean, we really played it straight and figured the chips are going to have to fall where they may.
Now, it must have impressed you, though, just from a fan's perspective. I mean, I understand from a producer's perspective it's uncharted territory, but when you were watching it, did it impress you?
It did. It did. It was amazing. And there were also the people who unfortunately had to face Ken, who had the advantage of not only being a superior player but also having the experience on the show. And then the way it all ended was so unexpected.
Yeah, just a little question about H&R Block and FedEx. That's it.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
It's a friend of mine always says game show contestants always never forget the questions they miss. They never they never remember the ones they get. They always remember the ones they miss.
Sure.
You know, and it's just very simple. Speaking of Mr. Jennings, and of course Brad Rutter, another spectacular Jeopardy player, I want to go back to 2011 and the Smartest Machine on Earth documentary, which, by the way, was an excellent, excellent documentary on Watson and IBM and the computer. Looking back upon it, was the Watson experience what you thought it was going to be, and what do you think about it?
It has turned out to be more than I thought it would be. We had no doubt that Watson was ready to play and ready to win. Watson went through hundreds of practice games with former Jeopardy players at the IBM headquarters in outside of New York. And so we saw a steady progression, and we finally deemed him ready to play, and so we set up the exhibition. And people have to remember that this was strictly that, an exhibition game. It was to show the capability of man to design a computer system that can understand natural language, process that language, and come up with correct responses to Jeopardy. What really attracted us to this in the first place was not the stunt or gimmick aspect of it, but IBM's stated purpose that this will, I know it sounds like, you know, use your superpowers for good, not evil, but that's kind of what it was. And they said, here's our long-term plan. We think that this has immediate applications for medical, for diagnostics, for treatment, for evaluation. And they've made good on their promise. There's a number of cancer research and treatment facilities, in particular Cedars-Sinai here in Los Angeles, and there are others on the East Coast as well. They're using Watson's capabilities to analyze data that will help physicians treat cancer patients.
Exactly. I mean, it was amazing. Going back, you were talking about, you know, writing for Ken Jennings back in 2004. Just in general, what is the procedure for a category to go from the writing team's idea to on the famous board?
It's a fairly long process, because the category has to be able to stand on its own, but it also has to be a good mix with the other categories. Sometimes, as you know, one category is paired with another. It has to be material that hopefully we haven't covered before, and if we have, then maybe we're using that same information but writing it in a different way, then assigning where it will be in terms of, is it a $200 clue, is it a $1,000 clue, and that's always highly subjective. The writers pitch ideas in their meetings. Then Billy Weiss, our head writer, will put it through into research, and it goes through a very, very, very vigorous research process. And if there are too many research problems with too many of the clues, that category might go away, or it might get amended quite a bit. And ultimately, Billy will design the games board by board, single, double, final Jeopardy. And then all the writers and researchers get together and they round table those games. And they try to poke holes in any of the information or the material. They try to determine what other responses might be acceptable, what would definitely not be acceptable. And then it gets programmed, and then it gets scheduled. Then the games come to me, and I review them, and then they go into the show.
Now, are you surprised how much Jeopardy, you know, we talked last time about how Wheel of Fortune is a pop culture fixture worldwide. Jeopardy is just the same. You know, you have Think music playing in baseball stadiums, in, you know, around the world. Of course, the Saturday Night Live skits. Does that surprise you as well?
Well, we love it. We were sorry to see Will Ferrell retire from
SNL. Yes.
He made a silly decision to go make $20, $25 million a movie.
Yeah, well, you know, that
staying and becoming Alex Trebek a few more times. It is surprising, but it's really hard for me to look at it completely objectively. Because I love this show. I love everything that it represents. And even through painful periods, like the controversy with young Mr. Hurley, I still love this game, and I love to see people playing it. And I love it when people tell me that, and I hear it more and more often, that in their house or in their parents' house or their friend's house, you know not to call them between 7 and 8 o'clock because they're watching Wheel of Fortune in Jeopardy. I mean, how could a producer hope for any more than that?
And, I mean, there's even a book series by Linda Fairstein, which started off called Final Jeopardy, where it's one of the running gags in the book is Final Jeopardy questions and bets during dinners. So I think it's pretty cool. I think
it is.
Okay.
It is.
Now, this all leads up to, of course, September 16th and the 30th anniversary season. What can you tell us so far, and what was about this request for Tournament of Champions players?
Well, I think this is going to be one of the most exciting seasons ever, not just because it's a milestone season. And I first want to preface that by saying we are very sensitive to celebrating these milestones in a way that provides a really solid answer to the viewers of what's in it for me. We don't like celebrations of milestones that are basically filled with one full season of all of us patting ourselves on the back for having stuck around so long. We think we have something for the 30th anniversary season of Jeopardy that the viewers, new viewers, longtime viewers, are going to love. It's called the Battle of the Decades Tournament. We have invited back 45 players, 15 from each of the three decades of Jeopardy. And each of those groups of 15 will compete in a tournament style play, where they will play against members of their peer group, of people who competed in their decade. So each of those three competitions will yield 5 winners. Those 15, three groups of 5, will then finish off the season in a 2-week Battle of the Decades finale that will yield one winner of $1 million.
Rumor is that the tournament will end back here in New York City in May?
We're still working on that. It hasn't been finalized yet. We're working on it. And my feeling is no matter where these 15 people play, it's going to be something that everybody will want to watch. I should also mention that... I'm sorry.
No. Go ahead. Mention whatever you want.
I should also mention that we have selected 14 out of each group to compete. The 15th slot is going to be a fan favorite, and we have offered up to the fans, and they'll be able to vote on it at our website. We've offered up to the fans some candidates to fill the 15th slot, and they'll vote, and they'll be able to select who they want to add to each of those groups of players.
Do you know when that fan vote will start, or is the fan vote now?
It will start in October.
Aha. Okay, very good. Unfortunately for me, outside of my asthma question, I'm not in the tournament. So that stinks for me. how is Alex doing, by the way, just in general?
Alex is doing great.
Okay.
He's doing great. He's had a very busy summer. He traveled like crazy, and he's got, in addition to obviously doing the shows here, he's got two big honors coming up, both of them in New York, and they are 2 weeks apart. One is October 16th. He's being honored along with a group of others as one of the giants of broadcasting. And then on October 28th, also in New York, he's being inducted into the Broadcasting and Cable Hall of Fame.
Wow, very cool. Very cool. Hopefully, maybe I could get to talk to him about that. That would be fun. I would love to do that. Pat, Mr. Friedman, thank you so much for giving us a little back voyage into history and a preview of the 30th anniversary season, which starts September 16th, a week from this coming Monday. Check your local listings for that. And for any other news, I believe there's a Jeopardy Twitter feed at Jeopardy. Jeopardy Facebook page, and of course Jeopardy.com. And the Jeopardy Instagram. I believe there's also. I also saw there's a new set coming for the 30th anniversary too. Yeah?
There is. It's really cool. We think everybody will like it.
All right. Listen. Thank you. Thank you again for your time out of your very busy schedule.
You're welcome, Jason. Always good to talk to you.
All right. Thank you very much.
You've been listening to a JWC Media produced program.